The title of my address this morning is The Garden. A few years ago, I was asked to write the introduction to a book of photographs, poems, and essays about the Irish National War Memorial Gardens. And since then, I've thought about them a lot. The gardens are nestled beside the Liffey, the main entrance tucked behind Gaelscoil in Chacor, and the St. John of God School in Island Bridge, Dublin 8. Officially, they're part of the Phoenix Park, even though they're on the opposite side of the river. Commemorations of the First World War remain contested in Ireland, although less than they used to be. In other jurisdictions, the architecture and social infrastructure of commemoration and the legacy of war is woven into everyday life. Local village monuments to the dead, family, military histories, and genealogies. I have never been comfortable with the valorization of military campaigns, despite having a grandfather and great-grandfathers who fought in wars. And this tension in remembering was also found in the attitudes of some local people towards the War Memorial Gardens, calling it Legion Park, in the decades after it was first built, unable or unwilling to see beyond political or cultural frames. We live in different times now, where the role and sacrifice of Irish soldiers in the World War I and World War II is acknowledged and properly commemorated. The Good Friday Agreement ushered in a new climate of respect that has been truly transformational in our country. While the War Memorial Gardens host annual services to remember the dead, they are no longer just a site to honour the past, but on sunny days are filled with families and dog walkers, people sitting by the riverside, watching the rowers from the boat clubs work their way to and from Chapel Izzard. Today, the Irish National War Memorial Gardens are variously referred to as the Memorial, the Rose Gardens, the War Memorial Gardens, or just the Gardens. Designed by the English architect Edward Lutyens, the idea for a war memorial for Irishmen had first been proposed in 1919. A committee was established to raise funds for a suitable commemoration. They commissioned the very best of Irish graphic artists, Harry Clark, to illustrate manuscripts recording the names of every known Irish soldier who had been lost in the war. These war books, running to 8 volumes, include just under 50,000 names and were completed between 1919 and 1923. Harry Clark created border designs in black ink, delicately mixing military scenes with Celtic revivalist iconography. The books needed a permanent home, and so the idea of a commemorative garden began to take root. It was not until 1929 that the present site, Long Meadows, was granted to the project, and the architecture of the memorial gardens that we see today was built in the 1930s. Yet Long Meadows has an older history. It is also the site of a Viking settlement and burial ground over 1,000 years old, so the symbolism of the gardens is complicated. Edwin Lutyens was an experienced architect in the design of both cemeteries and of war memorials. He designed Lambay Castle on Lambay Island and Howth Castle in the 1910s, which may explain his Irish connections to the memorial project. But he had also just finished a commission for a war memorial in New Delhi, for which he received a knighthood. His imperial credentials did not appear to be a problem for the Free State government. In fact, they were pleased to have the benefit of his expertise, and work on the gardens began in 1931. If you have never been there, let me try and paint a picture for you. The best way to enter the gardens is from a side gate on Concolbert Road. In the original plans, this was intended to be the main entrance. As you enter the park, you are taken down steps through a dark passage of evergreen oaks, until you emerge at the top of the gardens, where you step down into an open grass arena. This generous open space is circular, with a catafalque or war stone like a large granite altar at its heart. The war stone was intended to be a non-denominational monument for people of all creeds, and so it is here rather than at the base of the imposing cross that leads into the garden, where reeds are laid. Flanking the war stone on either side are two fountains with obelisks, and to each side of them are curved pergolas connecting the book rooms, which contain the illustrated manuscripts of the war names. Behind the pergolas on both sides are sunken, circular, and terraced rose gardens, each with steps leading down to a central lily pond. The intended and achieved effect is of a vast external cathedral whose vaulted ceiling is the sky and whose side chapels are rose gardens. Yet that is not all. Leaving the broad grass arena and moving away from the war stone, six giant bay trees mark a set of stone steps leading towards the river. These trees represent generals, and as you descend further down to the next level, there are rows of cherry blossom trees, glorious in April, in neat diagonal formations to represent battalions of soldiers. Walking through the soldiers brings you to a folly, a little temple perfectly sized for children to run through and around. And if you exit the gardens by a different route, your way is flanked by lime trees, soldiers on guard duty. As the year turns, their leaves move through shades of light green to russet, until all their beauty falls to the ground and makes the path a golden river. In winter, the gardens appear ghostly and dreamlike, centurion trees, skeletal and bare. In Theodor Ruffke's words, light making its own silence. They herald the landscape at the cusp of becoming, framed at the turn of day or the turn of season. The memorial gardens are slowly revealed as you walk into them, from whichever gate or entrance point. You cannot see them all at once. And this gradual revelation is part of the design and planned to create a particular experience. Standing in the open, flat heart of Lutyens Grass Arena, where the war stone occupies center space, you become aware of standing between earth and sky. And the encircling architecture, the book rooms, the pergolas, and the symmetry of the rose gardens invites the expansion not only of your vista, but also of your feelings. The gardens are a site of memory to remember the war dead, but they are also a reminder of the power of forgetting. Designed and built during a time when Ireland was extricating itself from empire, commemorating Irish soldiers' participation in the Allied forces was not popular. It became a matter of forgetting rather than remembering. The insistence on remembering, even when forgetting is easier, is one of the garden's lasting legacies. A garden, observed Emily Lawless, the Irish poet and naturalist, is a world in miniature, and like the world, has a claim to be represented by many minds surveying it from many sides. Literature is dotted with references to the pleasures and delights of gardens, from Andrew Marvell's evocation of a green thought in a green shade, to Francis Bacon's declaration that a garden contains the purest of human pleasures. In ancient Islamic cultures, there's a particular design that has become replicated across time. It's of an enclosed garden, organized along strict geometric principles, with a quatrefoil central pool or element of water. Historically, this type of garden is most closely associated with the Persian Empire, and particularly the vision of Cyrus the Great, who lived about 500 years before the birth of Christ. Over the centuries, his conception of a garden spread across the Islamic world, and in the 16th century, extended to the first Mughal emperor in India. And we can see representations of the Persian garden in miniature paintings, spaces with terraces and pavilions, a style that has come to be known as a paradise garden. Our understanding of paradise, or heaven, would suggest that gardens are temporal manifestations of a celestial place. The metaphor of the garden as a place of spiritual reflection is an ancient one. It represents renewal, cycles of life, sun, earth, death, burial, and resurrection. However, in her book, The Garden Against Time, Olivia Lang reveals that the etymology of the word paradise comes from an ancient Persian language to mean walled garden. So this means that our conception of paradise comes from the idea of a garden and not the other way around. As Lang says, it was the garden that came first, heaven trailing in its wake, an enclosed garden, a fertile, beautiful, cultivated space that gave rise to the concept of celestial space. The Bible is abundant with allegories to sowing and reaping. The Song of Solomon is replete with references to gardens, fountains, apples, figs, lilies, as manifestations of earthly and divine love. Excuse me. The Garden of Eden, so deeply embedded within our culture, as a lost place, a place to which we will be restored, a place without pain or death, and one of eternal rest, is powerful. But it does not represent the reality of a garden at all. John Milton's Paradise Lost, first published in 1667, is a passionate evocation of Eden as a place of lushness, growth, vitality, but also of work and the rewards of labor. Paradise Lost draws on the books of Genesis and Revelation and tells the story of Lucifer's fall and the expulsion of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden. Milton's Eden is not a garden of pretty flowers and neat beds requiring little attention, but is a place of untamed and wild abundance, with groves and glades and fields and shades of ripe fruit and fecundity. Eden is not cultivated and domestic, but unfettered and exciting. His poem was written at a time of civil and religious unrest in England and against a backdrop of plague. And perhaps today we better understand Milton's longing for wild landscapes, since our shared experiences of the fear of pandemic and the constraints of quarantine. Adam and Eve are not suburban inhabitants of the garden, but they are horticulturists. Their job is sweet gardening labor in a kind of ongoing dialogue with the garden's innate wildness as they work to maintain it through pruning and cultivation. As Eve says, "The work under our labor grows, luxurious by restraint. What we by day lop, overgrown, or prune, or prop, or bind, one night or two with wanton growth derides, tending to wild." Paradise Lost, Book 9. For Milton, ever the Puritan, Eve, of course, is closely associated with the chaotic, luxuriant, wild disorder of the garden and the need to contain it. But Eve strongly identifies with the garden she is so invested in. And in the poem, part of Eve's lamentation in being banished is how is she supposed to live without her garden, her natural element? How shall I part and wither, wander down into a lower world, to this obscure and wild? How shall we breathe in other air? Paradise Lost, Book 11. From Eden to Gethsemane, the garden and gardening are central metaphors for growth, but also grief. Excuse me. When Mary Magdalene sees Christ at the empty tomb, she initially mistakes him for a gardener. Jesus saith unto her, "Woman, why weepest thou? Whom seekest thou?" She, supposing him to be the gardener, saith unto him, "Sir, if thou have borne him hence, tell me where thou hast laid him, and I will take him away." John 20:15. In the Buddhist tradition, the garden is both a place of pleasure and a place of renunciation. The physical space of the garden is connected to a higher cosmos, reached by transcending the materiality of place. Gardens provide sensory delight, but also moral and intellectual restoration. They foster our understanding of the world. Gardeners tend, they do not grow. Reading about gardens and their importance as both wild and cultivated spaces, as physical and transcendental spaces, has made me think about the memorial gardens a little differently. Their perfect symmetry, their ornamental grandeur, their designed beauty. Because as Olivia Lang says, a garden exists on the threshold between artifice and nature, conscious decision and wild happenstance. It represents a miniature, a type of balancing act, a tension between the way the world is and the world as we desire it to be. Being a gardener is about being initiated into a different understanding of time. We plant for a future we may not see. Garden time is not like ordinary time, says Lang. It moves in unpredictable ways, sometimes stopping altogether, yet proceeding always cyclically in a long, unwinding spiral of rot and fertility. Gardens work against the fantasy of perpetual abundance. So many of our most destructive behaviours are predicated on denying impermanence and decay, insisting on summer all the time. Permanent growth, constant fertility, perpetual yield, instant pleasure, maximum profit, outsourcing the labour. To accept the presence of death in the garden is to refuse an illusion of perpetual productivity without rest or repair, an illusion purchased at a heavy, soon unpayable cost. The words of Livia Lang. To accept the presence of death in the garden is not only appropriate to us as gardeners, but also for an understanding of the garden as a repository of loss and remembrance. Gardens require continual attention, cultivation, and labor to thrive, as do we. The ancient Greeks had a word for it, eudaimonic, meaning flourishing, or living in accordance with the best of human principles and endeavors, which also means accepting impermanence and mutability. The idea of the garden as a space that brings out the best in us is particularly apposite when I think of the memorial gardens. Built to remember the price of our inhumanity, our capacity for conflict and brutality. The memorial gardens are a testament to the deeply scarring trauma of war, at the same time as they mark our capacity for forgiveness, reconciliation, regeneration, poetry, and love.